Welcome back. In 1818, English poet, freethinker, and romantic, Percy Bysshe Shelley published a poem entitled Ozymandias, a meditation on a statue of the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II. Ozymandias is the Greek transliteration of an alternate title for Ramses II, Usurmatre Serpenre, the justice of Ra is powerful, chosen of Ra. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies whose frown and wrinkled lips and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Well, in my first lecture, I talked about the aims and the general structure of this set of lectures. What I want to do at this point is talk about an understanding of the history and archaeology of this archaeological pursuit. The discipline of archaeology has its own history. It's an important history. And I think that some background in that history is going to be really important for this course as a whole, because we can't really understand modern archaeology without understanding its past. I will note that this is actually the way that I start all of my courses, with a historical introduction, an introduction that I hope gives some context, some background. Let's think about this poem for a moment, Ozymandias. What was the cultural milieu? It's a very well-known poem. What was the cultural milieu, though, that would cause a British poet to write this particular form of poem on this particular topic, on an archaeological topic, in the early 19th century? There's an appeal to romantic imagination, certainly, a meditation on hubris and the transience of wealth, power, and worldly things. This is all certainly true. But is that all that's to it? Is this simply a random choice of topics by Shelley? I don't think so. Let's put this then in some context. There was, in the early 19th century, a well-developed history in ancient societies held by Shelley and by his contemporaries. This was nothing particularly new at the time. There had long been an interest in the ways in which ancient societies worked. It was continually mutating. It was going off in different directions. It was changing its characteristics and its emphases through time. In Shelley's case, toward Romanticism. An interest in archaeology bent towards a romantic goal. And of course, this kind of mutation of interest is still going on. Research on ancient states and their origins still commands a disproportionate amount of attention in archaeology, both among professional archaeologists, this is what a lot of us do, and for the general public. Now, this is in itself interesting, given that these political systems and these cultural systems we call states and civilizations, have existed for less than 1% of the time that humans have occupied the earth. In part, we're interested in states and civilizations because we ourselves have now lived for centuries in a world of states. And so these social and political forms are both very familiar and, of course, of great interest to us. It's actually not as long as we might think, even in Europe, and certainly not in parts of the rest of the world. For example, in some areas of Western Europe, France perhaps, the idea of the state might not have meant very much to non-elites living beyond the capital well into the 18th or even the 19th centuries. I'll note one of the topics we're going to cover later on in this series of lectures is the ways in which archaeologists think about the borders and territories of ancient states, how ancient states control territory. This interest in ancient states and civilizations also has to do with the spectacular nature of the remains of many of these ancient civilizations. These rulers in ancient times were trying to impress, perhaps not people thousands of years later, but certainly their contemporaries. They were trying to impress, and they often managed to do so. So Ozymandias may be a poem about hubris and transience, but more than 2,000 years after Ramses II ruled, British romantics were still writing poetry about him. That's a victory, an immortality of a sort. However, this interest in ancient states and civilizations is also tied to the ways in which anthropology and archaeology developed as academic disciplines, which involved the study of classically and biblically known states around the Mediterranean and in the Near East. So we began as archaeologists by studying states. What's some of the background of this then? Well, we could trace some of this back to a little known but actually remarkably sophisticated academic intellectual work, Ibn Khaldun's Mukaddimah, completed in North Africa in the middle of the 14th century, which was the first systematic application of the scientific method to social relations. Not nearly as well known as it should be. But the Mukaddimah dealt in great part with topics like the rise and fall of political dynasties and the relationships of people within and beyond the borders of states. Now, Ibn Khaldun is not well known in the West today, but I would note this man was an extraordinary polymath who lived in North Africa and who wrote extensively on history, politics, geography, social relations, astronomy, and theology, among other topics. So we can begin perhaps with Ibn Khaldun. Moving to Europe, Renaissance era antiquarianism, with its passion for the classical world, involved collection of artifacts and the observation of architecture from ancient Greece, Rome, and neighboring states. So even in the Renaissance, then, we can see a developing interest among European elites in what the past was like, and also what the physical traces of the past were like. This involved the rediscovery, if you like, of the classical world as fundamentally different from late medieval society. Not merely an earlier version of that society. It was not merely collecting, I will note this. Antiquarianism was not merely collecting. We can think of, for example, Pompeii, which is inarguably, the world's oldest archaeological excavation, where work has been going on from the mid-18th century onward. This Renaissance antiquarian rediscovery of the classical world was paralleled in space by the discovery of the New World. So if we have the rediscovery of the classical world through time, then at the same time, in the early Renaissance, the discovery of the New World geographically and the discovery of people hitherto quite unknown to Europeans. This eventually extended to, if you like, the discovery of prehistory in Europe and across the world more generally. the realization that there existed periods of time entirely different from the classical Renaissance or post-Renaissance worlds. In very, very ancient times, people had lived before writing. And so there were peculiar challenges to studying their culture due to the absence of writing. Once you have this concept of prehistory, then archaeology follows as the only way of studying those ancient times. Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798 provided European intellectuals with unprecedented insights into ancient Egyptian culture, notably through the eventual decipherment of hieroglyphics. I'll talk about this later on, but just to note that here we had an ancient Egyptian writing system. It was known to Europeans, but undeciphered. The discovery of this seminal artifact, the Rosetta Stone, with the same text in classical Egyptian hieroglyphics, in another form of hieroglyphics called Demotic, and in Greek, allowed the eventual decipherment of ancient Egyptian. This, in turn, allowed direct insight into the culture of ancient Egyptians, not mediated via Greek and Roman writing, as had been the case before. These hieroglyphics lasted 3,000 years, but they were becoming obsolete and formulaic in the Roman period. After the invasion of Egypt, a variety of different individuals, we can call them archaeologists perhaps, moved into the Near East with a variety of different aims. We can think, for example, of Giovanni Belzoni, a real character. I would call him more a grave robber than an archaeologist, but responsible for the pillaging of a variety of Egyptian archaeological sites and for transporting the statue of Ramses II to London. The news of that arrival of that statue was, at least in part, inspiration for Shelley's grand poem Ozymandias. This was in turn part of a larger scramble for antiquities through all of the Near East. So it's fascinating that this beautiful poem, this high-flown meditation on hubris, it originates in a grubby little episode of theft of antiquities. Mid-19th and early 20th century excavations on sites in Mesopotamia and Palestine, sites described in the Bible, and at Troy, for example, as described in the Iliad, provided a further association between archaeological research and the development of ancient states and civilizations. At Troy, for example, here again, we have Heinrich Schliemann as adventurer and showman, as much as archaeologist. He was determined to locate the site of Troy, written about in the Iliad, and he did so. He at once demonstrated that the site was very complex and that it had a reality far beyond the Iliad. At the same time, he subjected his interpretations to the Iliad as if the Iliad was an objective historical text, which it certainly, in all sorts of ways, was not. I'll note here that one important element in all of these episodes was the decrepitude of the Ottoman Empire during the 19th century, really from the invasion of Egypt onward. This feebleness of the Ottoman Empire allowed Westerners, to a great extent, free rein to excavate in different parts of the Ottoman Empire, and as importantly, to take their finds back to museums hungry for artifacts in Europe and in North America, as with the statue of Ramses. And indeed, we have many, many other such examples. This still causes problems. tense relationships between European and North American museums and governments in other parts of the world. And we have to recognize that archaeologists could not get away with these actions today. This is a good thing. As I said last time, Indiana Jones is about 100 years out of date. Much of this interest in excavation lay in the verification of well-known historical texts, the Bible, the Iliad, the classical authors. This formed the basis of a close relationship between archaeology and written history, which continues, for better or worse, until the present day. Through this set of lectures, I'm going to be talking about the challenges of reconciling archaeological and historical data on ancient events. This presumption that the investigation of states, and in fact the investigation of kings and nobles, and the confirmation of historical sources should be primary aims of archaeology has continued in many other areas of the world. Thus, for example, in China, sites of the Shang Dynasty were among the first to see major excavations. They were preceded in China primarily by work on paleoanthropological sites, sites, for example, of Homo erectus, better known in the Chinese case as Peking Man. And I want to emphasize how disproportionate was the attention paid to written records and to the places where they'd been found, that is, palace areas and the state capitals that contain those palaces, within the archaeology of Shang, China. To a very great extent, the archaeology of Shang, China is an archaeology of the places that contain writing. In Mesoamerica and South America, the pattern's repeated. Archaeology tends to begin with the traces of states and the lives of their rulers, and only later begins to focus on non-state societies and the lives of common people. In sub-Saharan Africa, the picture's more complicated. For most of the last century, the continent has been known for research on our hominid ancestors, so that many people have heard, for example, of Lucy, may or may not know that that refers to a hominid known as Australopithecus afarensis. Perhaps they've heard of others, Sahelanthropus chadensis, for example, lots of good long Latin names. So Africa's known for work on ancient hominids, with investigations of later periods often being accorded lesser importance. In addition, in Africa, it has frequently been assumed that the inspiration for states came from beyond the continent, and thus the African cases would be less interesting. We now know this to be untrue. And the study of state formation and civilization in Africa is a central element in African archaeology. This is really has been a great breaking factor, something that's essentially retarded the growth of research in Africa. The common assumption since the 19th century that any cultural advances in Africa had to come from lighter-skinned populations beyond the continent. Archaeology was burdened by this nonsense for a long time. And I'll talk about this again later on. I'll compare this as well. We can compare this to areas of the world where we don't have this pre-existing history of states, where the archaeology came first. Thus, for example, in the Indus Valley, on the border between India and Pakistan, another area that we'll consider extensively during this course. Here I'd argue that Indus Valley archaeology has seen far more attention paid to settlement patterning beyond the urban centers, and far more openness to thinking about alternate forms of political organization than has been the case in many other regions. So that in some ways I think Harappan archaeology, that is the archaeology of the Indus Valley, we'll talk about, has in some ways benefited from the absence of an earlier historical tradition in the region. In a sense, this pattern of attention to states and their rulers is understandable, because the physical traces of states, their capitals, their palaces, their tombs, their monuments, tend to be the most obvious archaeological traces in the region. However, this can also result in a distorted view of ancient societies, one that pays too much attention, that accords too much weight to the lives and preoccupations of elites, and not enough to the experience of the vast majority of common people living in a state. This is also one reason why historical sources, which in the past were often or primarily about the lives of the powerful and important, this is why historical sources can sometimes work at cross purposes to archaeology. Archaeology is very good at looking at the lives of common people. So if we have historical data looking at the lives of the powerful and rich, and archaeology looking at the lives of common people, we may find some inconsistencies. Archaeologists have grappled with this issue for many years, and I'll be talking about some of their approaches to this problem, this overemphasis on elites, in coming lectures. One thing I'd like to note here is that I'm going to be talking a lot about discoveries and theories produced by archaeologists at various times in the past and continuing today. I've already mentioned Giovanni Belzoni and Heinrich Schliemann, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt and think of them as proto-archaeologists, if you like. I've also mentioned Ibn Khaldun, who wasn't an archaeologist, certainly wasn't, but his activities demonstrate the role that scholars working beyond the discipline can have on archaeology, even at centuries removed. We might say the same, for example, for Charles Darwin, whose theory of biological evolution has been modified, has served as an inspiration for anthropologists and archaeologists who consider the possibility of cultural evolution working in analogous ways. One might say the same, for example, of Karl Marx, whose writings on the relations of production and relationships between economic systems, social systems, and ideologies have been very influential in archaeology, in allowing archaeologists to tie material, cultural, and economic systems with other realms of human society and culture. But I'm also going to talk about a whole set of other archaeologists who've advanced the study of the origin of states and civilizations through their theoretical contributions and or their fieldwork. Usually both, because I think that the best theoreticians of archaeology are those folks who keep themselves solidly planted in a fieldwork program. Archaeology is a craft as well as an academic discipline. It involves getting dirty and wet a lot. Believe me, it does. And trying to wrest good interpretations from things like changes in soil color or soil texture. Trying to understand the relations of artifacts as they sit in the ground is absolutely central to what we do. And you can't take account of the craft of archaeology if all you do is sit in an office and do theory. So the combination, then, of these different elements is absolutely vital. So we're going to talk about archaeologists, like the Australian-born V. Gordon Child, whose writings, whose theorization was dominant in British archaeology through the middle of the 20th century. V. Gordon Child was an extraordinarily important synthesizer and theoretician One of his main areas of interest was the development of urbanism and the origins of states and civilizations on a global scale. And he was also well known for the integration of Marxist ideas about relationships between economic, cultural, and ideological systems. As I noted, this is very useful for archaeologists who, after all, reconstruct culture from material remains. We'll talk about Bruce Trigger, a Canadian archaeologist, someone who reviewed the first archaeology paper I ever tried to have published, and fortunately liked it. A really protean scholar who did work as an Egyptologist in both Egypt and Sudan, as well as conducting ethnohistorical research on North American Huron populations and writing probably the primary text on the development of archaeological theory. Particularly important for this course will be Trigger's work on the origins and developments of states in different parts of the world, a comparative study. And especially his analysis and his theorization on the difference between city states and territorial states. And this is a distinction that we'll be considering a lot in this set of lectures. Bruce Trigger, unfortunately, died just a few years ago. He was a very nice man. Ian Hodder, who began doing really quantitative archaeology, looking at the distribution of sites and artifacts across maps in the British Isles in the 1970s, then went on to do ethnographic work with modern African populations, especially in East Africa. Hodder became one of the most important archaeological theorists of the 1980s and 1990s with his critique of approaches that treated archaeology too much like a natural science. Ian Hodder is now director of the Chatalhoyuk Archaeological Project, which involves research on an extraordinary early farming community known as Chatalhoyuk in Turkey, one that we're going to look at in a later lecture. And here I note the movement from theorizing to fieldwork and back. The American Greg Pussell, a longtime researcher on Indus Valley sites in Pakistan, and the originator of really interesting ideas about the workings of Indus Valley societies 4,500 years ago, including the possible origins of Indus Valley states in an ideological revolution at that time. The Americans Rod and Susan Keach McIntosh, excavators of Djenejeno in the inland Niger Delta of Mali in West Africa, who revolutionized our understandings of the development of complex societies and urbanism in West Africa, demonstrating that these developed indigenously before significant contact with Islamic societies in North Africa in the late first millennium AD. The American Michael Mosley, whose maritime foundations hypothesis along the Pacific coast of South America has generated immense amounts of archaeological debate in that region. The fundamental issue here is the contributions that marine resources, especially foods like fish and shellfish, could play in supporting complex societies before much contribution from domesticated plants, and thus raising the question of whether we can have the origins of states in societies where agriculture was relatively not as significant. I could add many, many other individuals to this list. The basic issue here, the basic requirement, I think, is the combination of flexible and original minds with detailed knowledge of data concerning prehistory, both regionally and globally. It's only through the combination of both, flexible and original minds, and a knowledge of the data, the really lasting archaeological work gets done. In my next lecture, I'll continue talking about some of these issues of doing archaeology in different parts of the world, how we think about the archaeological quest and the study of ancient states and civilizations. Thank you.